And I'm here looking out over the glistening Atlantic waters of Dunmanis Bay, sandwiched between the bays of Bantry and Roaring Water here in majestic West Cork. It's a beautifully peaceful area, of course. The bay has a scattering of boats bobbing up and down. But 400 years ago, Canty's Cove, where I am now, was part of a piracy and smuggling ring where pirates sailed between Ireland, the Caribbean and the West Indies. So you don't have to watch the Pirates of the Caribbean to get your maritime fix, just stay listening. And our Ciara Knightley this morning is marine archaeologist Connie Kelleher, while her twin brother Connor bears a striking resemblance to Johnny Depp. Now, Connie, why is this Canty's Cove? Why is it called Canty?
Canty was he was a Gaelic sublord under the main O'Mahony lords here in the 1600s, and indeed before that he would have got his lands from the O'Mahonys, who were the ruling Gaelic lords in the area all around. In fact, all of Dunmanis Bay, the coastal area of Dunmanis Bay, is dotted with the O'Mahony castles, and Canty lived here. This was his territory, hence it's called Canty's Cove. He would have been originally O'Canty. He intermarried with the O'Dolligs, or the Daily Bards, and they were the official bards of the O'Mahony lordships.
So some sort of Irish derivation then, because Canty wouldn't be a name around Cork, would it?
Not really, it wouldn't be that common, but it's again, it's been probably anglicised down through the period, and it's now known as Canty's Cove.
And we're standing here on the slipway of this gorgeous cove. You'd never know it was here, Connor.
No, it's incredibly secluded, well hidden from the seas and that, which is exactly what the pirates would have wanted for smuggling. And surrounding us here is just bare rock covered with bracken, some royal fern, some stunted oak trees because they're so close to the sea. But some of the flora here as well is scabious and purple loose stripes. There's some common centauri up there, some sea pinks as well.
This slipway here is covered in a kind of slimy green colour, which comes from the copper.
More than likely from the copper area.
Yeah, this area would have been rich both in the prehistoric mines, copper mines in Mount Gabriel, and also the later 19th century mines around the area like Cushing, and they would have been mining copper ore from the local rock. So it's extremely rich, and you can see the copper staining in the rocks, in the sand, and it gives the whole bay this kind of tropical
scintillating colour, isn't it?
Scintilling turquoise blue, almost as if you're in the Caribbean itself. So it probably, when the pirates were here just after coming from the Caribbean, they felt at home when they saw the blue.
The cove itself must be what? I mean, I'm not very good with distance, but it's very narrow.
I'd say it's about more like 100 metres wide, and shooting off at then there's little alcoves and caves which have been used by the smugglers for hunting or for concealing their ill-gotten gains, basically. But nowadays it's being used by wildlife. Some bat species will be using the sea caves here, as they are up in the further up the west coast in Kerry, for instance. Lesser harsher bats use sea caves, and it'll be the same down here.
And if we go over to the edge of the water and look over, a good place for landing boats.
Absolutely, and bearing in mind the slipway that we're standing on at the moment is a fairly modern slipway, probably over the last 30 years. This was built with the older pier behind us having been built in the 1920s, reputedly from the stone from Canty's house or Canty's castle, which is just over the crest of the rock face there to our left, which we'll go have a better look at later on.
We'll have a walk up, and that's just where the ferns are, Colin.
It's just where the ferns are overlapping the edge of the cliff, basically. And there's some very steep areas within the ferns, so you have to be very careful on your footing up there. It's a bit dodgy.
As you can see with the tide coming in now, the depth in this bay is fairly phenomenal. You could have got...
Immediate depth, yeah.
Immediate depth is, I mean, it's 5 or 6 metres in areas where you'd only expect maybe 2 or 3, so you could certainly have got in medium, small and medium craft in here. And once they were in here, they were secluded, they were cut off, and they wouldn't have been noticed from the outside. So it was an ideal bay to facilitate piracy and smuggling in its heyday.
So take us back 400 years. The reason we're down here is, of course, because of this historical connection with piracy and smuggling. 400 years ago, what would this place have looked like?
400 years ago, you were looking at what's in historical documentations called the Confederacy of Pirates. Piracy and privateering, kind of a legitimate form of piracy, has been noted in the history books all around Ireland from very early periods, Norman periods onwards and earlier. But really it was the 1600s that we saw the Confederacy of Piracy, based in Skull primarily, but facilitated by all the little local harbours such as Canty's Cove. The primary reason for the growth in piracy at the time was Elizabethan privateers during the wars with Spain preceding the Battle of Kinsale were extremely prevalent, and the control of the harbours in Ireland was essential because they were strategically located to any invasion in England. So the harbours themselves would have been a focus of privateering during the Elizabethan time. But then, of course, after the Battle of Kinsale and when peace was formulated with Spain, you had literally thousands of sailors out of work who were previously
nothing to do,
and all they knew was the sea. So they, an obvious step for them was to go into piracy. And under James I, he, in times of peace, had no tolerance at all for piracy or privateering, saw no place for it. So essentially, most of these sailors turned to piracy. And they were so strong, they came into harbours like Skull, and they brought in so many boats with them and ships that they couldn't really be beaten. The Navy at the time had been downgraded under James, and they weren't up to scratch enough to actually go and take the pirates on firsthand. So you had a huge growth in piracy. It would really be called the golden age of Irish piracy.
And this was at the beginning of the 1600s?
This was from roughly the golden age of piracy in the southwest was roughly from 1603 right up to about 1612. There was no direct legislation against it in Ireland at the time. There was in England, but so if a pirate was caught in Ireland, he would have to literally be taken over and deported to England to be tried and executed. So really, by the time England could react at all to piracy over here, the pirates were well gone and the smugglers were well hidden again. They did send some deputies over here to try to curb the piracy on the ground. William Hull was probably the most famous. He was based in Skull and he built up a big complex in Skull. But he joined forces with the pirates when he came over here. Such was the lucrative business that was going on. And he actually became noted as the greatest land pirate in his time.
A land pirate,
because he facilitated the actual pirates in Skull at the time under Richard Bishop. Most of these pirates were English. You would have had some Dutch coming in, some Irish, obviously.
And so Skull would have been the centre of kind of coordination, if you like, of the pirates.
They would have in those times, and it was right on the Atlantic fringe, which meant that the 1600s was when the whole trading routes with the East Indies and the West Indies was opening up. It was easy pickings for them. They just could take ships that were going to or coming from the West Indies or the Caribbean with large cargoes of things like linen, cochineal beetles, which were highly prized, but also wine, brandy, spirits, and also the gold and the silver that was coming in from places like Mexico. One notable one actually wrecked in Castlehaven Harbour down beside Baltimore, and it was part of the Spanish silver fleet. And it wrecked down there in 1628, and that was taken by a privateer from Cuba. She's wrecked in Castlehaven. So from an archaeological perspective, it's those kind of that sites that we're looking to get some evidence for the pirates, and it's there where things like rock-cut steps come as the physical evidence for this clandestine activity that was going on.
Because
it all together, and by its very nature, they were trying to keep it quiet and secret. So we're looking to the shipwrecks and the actual rock-cut steps and the little coves like these to see if we can grasp any physical evidence for what we have in history.
And speaking of physical evidence, behind us here at the beginning of the cove, across the way, is this what looks like a kind of perfect landing place for boats. And you believe this was actually cut out by the pirates, by Canty?
I would say that was cut out. It looks deliberately cut out. It's a rock-cut ledge. Coming down, you have the sheer cliff, and then you have the rock-cut ledge cut out to facilitate what would have been a fairly primitive slipway or pier, where they would have drawn up their boats, and you could have people on the land coming down from those steps, probably, that are now well overgrown and that aren't visible anymore. And they would have used that as their original pier, basically, where they could bring up their boats, offload their cargo of contraband goods and take them inland. And in turn, the people would bring, obviously the pirates would be revictualling when they come in. So the people in turn would bring them down sheep and beef, butter, things like that to revictual their ships.
This little cove here is a good example of the kind of secrecy you need, Connor, to be a pirate, because you don't do it in the open. You want to do it in somewhere like this where it gives you little places you can hide the loot and also land without other people seeing you.
But you can imagine how secluded it would be even after nightfall then as well, because we're looking at it in daylight and it's fairly secluded as it is. But after dark, it would be even better still with torchlight processions coming down the old steps to pick up the loot that was brought in and that. And there was a lot of trade going on here between them and that, and they would have lived off the local produce while they were here as well, the fish and the fishing industry, basically. They'd be living on those, and also the whales that are in the sea out here as well, because it's a very good place to actually sit and watch whales passing by down the Sheep's Head. Off the coast here as well, you get things like killer whales, you get minke whales, harbour porpoises, and you get bottlenose dolphins as well.
So it's no wonder Canty decided across the way, we'll go up there in a minute, he decided to live here as well.
Exactly, yeah, it was a perfect, beautiful lookout spot as well.
It was all about control as well, and it was People think it was very ad hoc, but it actually was well administered, and it was all about control of the resources, control of the landscape, and really kind of exploiting those who were exploiting the landscape. So it was a whole series of administration and exploitation. The Gaelic lords would have facilitated their sublords, like the O'Manys would have facilitated Canty, who in turn would pay them revenue. He would have got his wealth from exploiting those who were exploiting the sea, the locals, the smuggling, the pirates coming in, and in turn they would have paid revenue to him, and he again would have paid revenue to the lords.
So it's a mafia ring.
It was almost a mafia, but it was hugely symbiotic relationship. Each one really depended on the other.
And you're a marine archaeologist. What kind of wrecks have you found around this area that relate to that time?
There's one around the corner in Ahaleys called the Pearl, which went down in the early 1600s, around 1613. And her exact location hasn't been found. She was an East Indiaman privateer stroke pirate vessel wrecked down off Ahaleys. But it's only through artefacts being washed up on the beach, such as cannonballs and ship's timbers, that we know that that's the general location for a wreck such as that ship. Yeah.
And so the golden age, as you say, of piracy in Ireland was from the beginning of the 1600s, but it didn't last that long, did it?
Didn't last that long, and that was really to do with the southwest and the coastal trading routes opening up. It didn't last that long. They were so strong down around here, they couldn't really beat them. So they actually issued pardons. So they invited the pirates to accept pardons. And that's what they did. So instead of being caught and executed, they accepted pardons. And many of them got into legitimate business. One, Sean Ashton, who settled in Skull, he became a shoemaker. Another guy, Richard Robinson.
It's a bit of a letdown from being pirate, isn't it?
I know. Another guy got into Richard Robinson in this area, started making pal staves for barrels, again, to do with shipping of wine and hogshead of beer and things like that.
Part of what they smuggled was wolf skins, Connor. And I suppose this time, 400 years ago, what you would have heard at night would have been something completely different from what you hear now.
Yes, indeed. Wolves were incredibly common in Ireland in those days because they were very much under attack and threat from hunters in Britain, so they had reduced the population over there, but they were very common in Ireland right up through the 1600s, and there was bounties put on their heads, say by Cromwell later than the piracy period, of up to £9 per wolf skin, which was incredible money. In those days. So in one case there was 9,000 to 10,000 wolf skins being exported per year from Ireland. So it wasn't long before they started wiping them out, but the wolf in Ireland actually hung on around this area. I think the last one was killed in Cork, and there's various rumours as to when it was killed. Some say 1783, but others say that they actually hung on until 1810. And so while you were in Cork City, you could hear the wolves howling in the hills around the city.
Would have been an amazing sound.
Incredible out here, but the land was much more forested in those days, so they had places to hide. So a lot of the forestry was cut down just to rid the place of wolves, but also rid the place of not just smugglers but highwaymen as well, who were hiding in the forest, and so that was another reason it was cleared.
These were local people who knew the land better than anybody, and they just knew where to hide out.
Why don't we take a walk along outside of this cove, along the little road that leads us up to the right hand side and over to the garden. Canty's reign wouldn't have been long.
The story goes about Canty that he was the local pirate and murderer, and he used to lure captains from ships up to his castle. When he had him found and fed and well watered, as it were, well drunk, he'd shove them over the cliff and he'd then take their boats. But a son of a pirate captain a ship's captain who had actually been thrown over the cliff came along, and I think sometime around the mid-1600s, just as Canty was about to push him off, he turned around and pushed Canty off. So he died sometime around the mid-1600s.
It's a bit of a lazy way to be a pirate, isn't it?
It is, really. It's kind of, how would I say, a dishonourable way to behave as a dishonourable pirate, I suppose.
But we're just passing some divers here. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Enjoy the diving. And Con, as we go up this steep little slope here, it can't have been easy for the pirates to have brought all the goods up this way.
Definitely not, and it was a lot worse in those days. We're actually walking on a surface that's about 3 metres over the surface they would have walked on, which was just slippery rocks, basically. But you can see they've cut some parts of the rocks in to make it an easier walking platform up here and onto this, as far as the steps. Well, we have it easy these days compared to, especially if they were doing it at night time in the dark, they want to be fairly sure-footed.
The film representation of pirates is that they should be feared. I mean, would they have been respected? Would they have been feared by the local community?
Oh, they would have very much been welcomed by the local community. I mean, a lot of the local community depended on that kind of activity, because they would have got goods that they normally wouldn't have had access to. and they would have been able to get foodstuffs that they normally wouldn't have had access to. So,
and introducing the kind of trade routes with things like dyes and produce that you couldn't get in Ireland.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, a lot of it would have had to be handed over to the lords, the ruling lords, such as the O'Driscolls in Baltimore. They had the right of wreck, they had the right of, they were admiral of their harbour, so therefore most of the goods would have been handed over to them when they were acquired in the first place. But again, the locals would have been able to get access to things like brandy and wine, where they would normally not have had access to that.
And it would be nice, Connor, to think that the name Skull comes from the skull and bones and all the old piracy words, but it doesn't, of course.
It doesn't. Skull derives from Skull, the school. I was thinking maybe skullduggery came from it as well, but it isn't. Sometimes on the Ireland Survey maps you'll see it spelled as S-K-U-L-L. It's actually S-E-O-I-L in Irish, so it derives from the school.
It probably came from the original bardic school of the O'Dolics, who were the main bards to the O'Mahony lordships, and had their actually bardic school across the way in Kilcrahan, again overlooking Dunmanis Bay, and actually almost directly across from Kenty's Cove. So Skull would have come from that. It was the school of the bards where they serenaded the lordships.
Tell them how wonderful they were.
How wonderful they were and how great they were. And it was very much an oral tradition and an oral history at the time. Very little was written down.
And Conor, as we walk along here towards Canty's Garden, what hasn't come out yet is the Mumbrisha, which is so typical of this part of Ireland, isn't it?
Exactly. It should be flowering in the next couple of weeks now. Usually in July and August it comes forward. But it's one of the alien invaders that have come in. But this particular alien doesn't do much harm compared to some of the other ones you'll see around here.
It's a bit of colour, really, doesn't it?
It does indeed, around the roadside.
And the fuchsia's out already.
The fuchsia's a wonderful colour as well, and it's a welcome plant. It's just ahead of us there now. But there's some other more unwelcome guests around here, like Japanese knotweed and gunnera. There was a large plantation of gunnera earlier I passed. These things are fairly alien species that we don't actually like in the countryside, because they tend to take over and prevent other native plants from growing beneath them.
And Japanese knotweed was introduced when into Ireland?
Well, it came in as a garden plant, basically, and it escaped into the wild. It wasn't actually introduced into the wild purposefully. Lots of these alien invaders tend to self-seed and become naturalised in the wild and be able to survive, especially in a warm climate like we have down the southwest here. You get strange things growing, like Australian palm trees, for instance, because it's a very mild climate, even in the winter time down the southwest. So they can tolerate the climate. This plant here, called Meadow Sweet, it's got a lovely, marvellous sweet perfume. And in the old days, maybe around the days of the pirates and that, in medieval times as well, they used to spread it inside in houses on the floor, so as when you'd walk around in it, it would scent the air. It was their idea of Oust or Nutridol for air fresheners, basically. Like, you know, I remember my grandfather, when we were young, used to make a home brew out of it. He used to call it Snasnacnig. In English, that's the shine of the hills. It was thoroughly horrible stuff. It was like medicine. But he used to drink it by the jar load of it anyway. But
did you drink it?
I tried it once. I tasted it once. It was just disgusting. But I don't know how potent it was. It was just hideous out of the meadow sweet. And then there's ragwort as well here. And at the moment, the young of the cinnabar moss is actually apparent on the ragwort. They're these black and yellow caterpillars.
Can we find any?
No, the ragwort is actually poisonous. Poisonous to livestock. That's why people don't like it, and it's actually illegal to actually grow it in your fields, but there's more and more of it growing every year. Sometimes you see entire fields covered in it, but I like it because of the actual moths that live on it. The caterpillars actually absorb the poisons from the plant, and so they prevent things from eating them, like birds avoid them and that, because they'll end up getting poisoned in as well. But when they develop into a moth, it's a beautiful kind of a cinnabar, kind of a red and black colour, and it's a day-flying moth. It's very like the six-spot burnet moth, for instance.
And as we look behind us now, we can see a much better view of Dunmanis Bay, and then to the right, this undulating hill.
It's a fantastic view of the actual bay, and you can see the extent of it and how this area, if you're up on a height here, you could have commanded what ships were coming in and coming out, and you could have
perfect view.
The hill that's beside us there, which is Cnucan Púca, meaning the hill of the Púca, or the hill of the ghost. A lot of the time there would have been either a castle site up there or a signal tower, but they used semaphores with the use of fire, and they would have been intervisible with each other in the landscape. So they would light a fire on the top of the hill, and they'd warn the next castle or the next settlement that there was something coming in. So it was a way of them having their own kind of signal signalling system at the time, particularly if it were times of war. If Spanish fleets were coming in, they could warn each other of that. So it was all about commanding the landscape and commanding the seascape in order to control what you were doing and control your kind of return on the exploitation of that landscape.
And you can see another strange invasive plant we've had here. Well, an alien species is the New Zealand flax. This has been brought into Ireland as well as an ornamental plant in gardens. And if you go up, say, to North Mayo, for instance, where there's very little hedgerow along the bogland up there, and the local people are actually using New Zealand plant as the hedgerow boundary plants along fields. And it's a really strange plant to see this kind of really exotic thing growing.
It looks like old man's fingers.
Exactly,
it?
Yeah, it's really strange. I mean, it's all over North Mayo and they actually use it as a hedging plant up there, so it's a very strange little thing indeed. But again, that's not a native plant species.
And we're passing someone's house here and there's plenty of rhododendrons in there as well.
Rhododendrons, unfortunately, yeah. But these are...
The list of all the alien species.
Yeah. Rhododendron ponticum is around here as well, and that's causing untold damage in some areas like Glenveagh and Killarney National Park because it does blot out all the light from anything that might be growing the ground floor underneath it.
But sure, we can't be too negative because then you have this gorgeous row of fuchsia here fuchsia to the left, which is just lovely. And the Mombrisha is gorgeous when it comes out.
If you pick off the flowers of the fuchsia, you can actually suck the nectar, the sweet nectar, out of the back of them.
Oh, I've really done that, yeah.
Children always do it. It's lovely in the summertime to do it. It doesn't harm anyone. It's quite nice, like, you know, sweet. That's what the bees are after.
And we're going to take a little left turn here along a rougher road to get down to Canty's garden.
If you just hear that bird singing there, it's a sedge warbler. These are one of the summer vagrants that come into our country. A lovely visitor during the summer. And some of these warblers can be very confusing. You can tell them apart by their songs, but individually they do look very similar to one another. He's a very good songster. We can't actually see him inside in this fuchsia bush, but he's singing away behind us.
Let's see if we can get a sound of him. Not a bad voice.
No, he's lovely, isn't he?
Sings on demand.
Yeah. And he's not afraid of us either, like, you know. There's some other bird species around the headland here as well. You get stone chats and wheat ears. Wheat ears are another vagrant species that come in here during the summer months. And you get meadow pipits around here as well, which are kind of the Mars bars of the countryside, really, because...
That's a bit insulting.
The Big Macs of the countryside, because practically everything eats them. It's a very good place here as well, obviously, for seabirds. I've been watching cormorants feeding off the shore there, and kittiwakes flying over, and seagulls as well. And you get further out to sea, in around here, you get the storm petrels and skuas and shearwaters coming close, following trawlers to try and eat the offal off the backs of trawlers when they're coming in from the fishing trips.
I always get confused between cormorants and shags. It's very difficult to tell them apart by the naked eye, anyway.
Well, usually you see them at a great distance, maybe sunning themselves on a rock out to sea on an island or something like that, so they can look quite similar. But the cormorants now wouldn't be a friend to fishermen or anything, because you get more and more of them in inland waterways, in rivers and lakes and that, and they take the fish, but they don't take that many, to be honest, like, so they're not really competition. They just get blamed.
Not as many
basically
as we take.
No, they're one of the two-sided birds, really, like, you know, so they can swim underwater. They're more graceful underwater than they are on land, swimming as they do with their wings underwater. And that.
What a view we have now.
So from that's a vantage point like here now, you'll be able to see the blow of a whale if there was one out there. And it's very good what you do if you're sitting here with binoculars or a telescope or something watching for whales. You might be able to see the spout up in the air as the whale is breaching and breathing. But what you actually have to watch out for as well is the behaviour of the birds, because if the whales are actually feeding out there, they'll drive the shoals of fish to the surface, and then the birds pinpoint the fish so they come down for a feed. So where you see actual
birds diving,
flocks of gannets coming into the top of the water, it's a sure sign that there's something pushing the fish up from underneath. So it's a good sign to watch out for if you want to see something like a humpback whale. It's into the landscape anyway, at last.
And we're coming down now, finally, to our destination, which is Canty's garden, which will give us a much better view over the cove that we were at earlier, won't it?
Yeah, it'll give us a good view of the area and the kind of view that Canty and the likes of Canty and the lords around the area would have taken, so that they could command the sea and see who was using their waterways.
And it's hard to describe how blue the sea is at the moment. It is this intense sort of...
It's absolutely fantastic. It's the true aquamarine
that
is often described. And to find it in Ireland, it looks almost tropical.
There's just some fox droppings just to avoid stepping on it there. We saw a little fox earlier here just watching us watching him, so they are around.
And over here, we're looking right down. I'm not very good on distance. How many metres, Connor?
I'd say about 15 metres down.
15 metres down. And the swirling waters below.
Yeah,
and then you can see something quite special.
Yeah, it's another narrow inlet just around the corner from Kenty's Cove proper. And here you can see directly cut into the rock, these rock-cut steps hewn out of the actual rock leading down kind of ahead of us at an angle.
Aren't they incredible? They are his steps.
They're known as the pirate steps. This is in Irish Cuasán Stéire, meaning the kind of cove of the stairs or the cove of the steps. Perfect example from a cultural and archaeological perspective of evidence for this kind of clandestine activity. Secluded steps leading down into this little harbour where boats coming in the dead of night could have been accessed and the goods from them taken off them or indeed put onto them. A lot of this has collapsed into the sea and it's no longer connected to the area where his garden would have been. This is one of two known sets of rock cut steps in the area, the other one leading directly into his garden and this one just slightly west of it. Give access to the sea, both from the sea and to the sea.
And Connor, as you said, plenty of places beside the steps. If I just peer down below to see them, you can see places as well that they could have hidden the goods.
Exactly, there's all little fissures and crevices in the rocks down there and all. Plenty of bolt holes if they needed it from any burying eyes and that, so they could easily hide away down the rocks just below us.
All we need is a few howling wolves.
Yes.